including education, health care, corrections, military training, and veteran programs. He envisioned a time when teachers all over America would teach mindfulness to students, doctors would recommend it to their patients, and Marines would learn it in basic training. Along the way, he had hit some real roadblocks. He had established a weekly meditation and yoga session called Quiet Time, which was well attended by a bipartisan group of Capitol Hill staffers. However, his fellow legislators had been loath to hop on board, at least publicly. Meanwhile, a local public school back in his home state of Ohio had decided to stop teaching mindfulness to students under pressure from parents who feared meditation ran counter to their faith, which, according to Tim, was, quote, a real shame. In the midst of all this, though, he had developed some pretty good approaches for taking the stink of weirdness off meditation. When it comes to the religious concerns, he pushes back with the science. Look at the brain research. Don't listen to me. No one has to give up any religion that they believe in, but look at the science. We want to help your kid develop their brain. If we know this stuff, why is it not getting down to the kids in my district? That's unfair. That's unfair for my kids. For busy staffers on the Hill who worry that, in Tim's words, you're slacking if you're going to do this, he relies on strategic name-dropping. You've got to say Phil Jackson. You've got to say Kobe Bryant did this. Not exactly slackers. They found it is a performance enhancer. This is a technique I heartily endorse. When I speak publicly about meditation, I am constantly referring to unlikely meditators, including Steve Jobs, Novak Djokovic, the Chicago Cubs, and employees at major corporations such as Google, Procter & Gamble, Aetna, Target, and General Mills. It's not entirely dissimilar to the way I have long defended myself against people who accuse me of being soft for liking cats. I point to icons of machismo such as Ernest Hemingway, Winston Churchill, and Dr. Evil. While pushing for greater adoption of meditation can feel slow and frustrating at times, I remain convinced it is the next big public health revolution. I think in the not-too-distant future, mental exercise will be considered to be as important and mainstream as physical exercise. Think about it. Running used to seem weird to many people just a few decades ago. Same with yoga and sushi. The arc of history is, I believe, heading in the right direction, on this score at least. For his part, Tim seemed utterly undeterred by the hurdles he had faced in spreading meditation. He was resolute about chipping away at an issue that had long concerned both Jeff and me as well, the fact that meditation was largely the province of white, upper-middle-class Whole Foods shoppers. That's not a knock on those people. I am one of those people. But this health-improving, sanity-boosting practice should be available to anybody who wants it. As Tim put it, why is it just wealthy people who can afford to go on a retreat who have this? To me, this is a social justice issue. After the interview, the team had a convivial family-style dinner at a delicious Korean fried chicken spot, even though most of us were dragging. Our decision to sleep on the bus the night before had turned out to be a mistake. We drove through a winter storm with whistling winds and pounding precipitation. Despite the fact that the coffin beds were comfortable, I was up most of the night worrying that the bus might veer off the icy road. I was enduring extravagant bouts of prapancha, that ancient term for spasms of often phantasmagoric prospection, about crashing, and I worried that if we survived, I would be too tired the next day to function. In my own oft-repeated version of the fallacy of uniqueness, I had assumed that everyone else was snoozing soundly. But when we arrived in Washington the next morning, it turned out that most of the team was as sleep-deprived as me, including our normally unflappable director, Eddie, who seemed completely drained. Nonetheless, we had managed to make it through the day on Capitol Hill. We had also resolved not to sleep on the bus again. After dinner, we boarded the Orange Behemoth for the several-hour drive to our hotel. I went to my bunk for a video chat with Bianca and Alexander. I'm not a huge fan of talking on the phone. Behind the scenes, as my wife has noted ruefully, this professional talker can be downright monosyllabic. However, I had learned the hard way that calling my wife every day is a must. Many years prior, in the early days of our relationship, I had spent a week on assignment in Haiti and had called only sporadically. I got so caught up in my own work that I left her wondering and worrying about my well-being for days. Let's just say it never happened again. With Alexander now on the scene, I had added incentive to stay in touch, although, in a bit of poetic justice, he usually ignores me during our calls. Jeff and I had warned Bianca that we would be having the film crew record us as we checked in with her every day to ask whether she was meditating. She was prepared, albeit warily, to play along, but I told her the team was too exhausted to follow through tonight. After we hung up, I vegged for a while, alternately watching TV shows and staring at pictures of Alexander, including one where he had ice cream all over his face and looked like the youngest member of the Insane Clown Posse. Meanwhile, other folks were either chatting up front or engaging in a vigorous game of dice in George Clinton's rear cabin. All of us were blissfully unaware that our next interviewees had also considered bailing on us because they, too, were worried about looking weird. The next morning, we showed up at Virginia Military Institute. Sometimes called the West Point of the South, VMI is the oldest state-supported military college in the United States. The campus sprawls over 200 well-tended acres, and there are more than a few cannons. This is not a place for the faint of heart. Freshmen are known as rats. They get screamed at all the time and have to drop and do push-ups on demand. They can't watch TV, listen to music, or use the phone without supervision. The remaining 3 years don't get much easier. We set up our cameras in a wood-paneled room in the library. On the wall was a portrait of the Confederate General Stonewall Jackson, bearded and with a heavy brow, who taught natural and experimental philosophy at VMI back in the 1850s and was said to have been a strict and inflexible teacher. One of my producers pointed out that the general was also known to eat lemons like apples. He looked like he might have snacked on gravel as well. As we were milling about, waiting for the cameras to roll, we learned that the administration had nearly scrapped the whole shoot. The school's communications honcho explained that VMI had been through a public relations debacle a few months earlier when news broke that officials had given out coloring books as a way to help cadets deal with stress, a move that was perceived by some as too touchy-feely for one of the nation's premier military academies. The press had a proverbial field day. Alumni were up in proverbial arms. The school now feared our on-camera session might devolve into a gooey celebration of the cosmic benefits of meditation, and they'd be exposed to further criticism and mockery. Enter Colonel Holly Joe Richardson, Ph.D., a physical fitness instructor with short red hair, and Major Matthew Jarman, a baby-faced assistant professor with a doctorate in psychology. The two strode into the room wearing impeccably pressed uniforms. Both Richardson and Jarman had recently begun teaching meditation to the cadets in their respective classes. They disclosed that when they had first begun doing so, they were a little apprehensive. To sell the practice, they relied on the same tactics Tim Ryan employed, an emphasis on the science that suggested health benefits, including increased resilience to post-traumatic stress disorder, a scourge of the modern military, and a spotlight on the aspirational figures who were meditating themselves, especially professional athletes. Jarman added a fresh twist to the sales pitch. As a pushback against the argument that you're a wuss if you meditate, he essentially argued that you're a wuss if you don't do it. He said, meditation isn't this soft, fluffy thing. You're facing your fears. You're facing your stresses head on. You're kind of leaning into them, and it's giving you the tools to do that more effectively and to not be swept away by them. This approach appears to have worked. The classes in which meditation was taught were well subscribed. Richardson said there was widespread recognition that stress is, quote, endemic at VMI. Specifically, she said she thought cadets could use mindfulness so they could withstand their first year here. Jarman acknowledged that concerns about teaching mindfulness in a military context come from two sides. Some meditation purists consider it a perversion of their beloved practice. He said, is it ethical to teach meditation practice to people who might be killing others? From his perspective, the answer to that question is yes. He said, mental training helps you make better decisions, which, quote, hopefully result in as few casualties as possible. Further, in his class, called Modern Warriorship, he defines a warrior as, quote, one who creates change of some sort. He added, you can trace the word war to creating disorder and change. Jarman sees warriors as actors not merely on the battlefield, but also in schools, businesses, and families. their primary focus, he believes, should be on helping others. And mindfulness, he says, is an essential skill for this kind of fight. He said, some cadets tell me that their roommates kind of make fun of them, but this ribbing, he said, is a good test. Part of being a change maker, he said, means you're going to be going against a lot of people. If you can't do something as simple as meditating and be okay with the fact that others might think it's a little weird, then you're not really getting into the training yet. It's such a minimal threat as far as the grand scale. At which point, Jeff chimed in, and part of being a warrior is going against the stream. That term, going against the stream, speaks to the revolutionary message at the heart of the meditative endeavor. To go against the stream is to refuse to be swept up in the dominant culture of unconsciousness, to carefully examine the conventional narratives and assumptions of the day. As Jeff said, the momentum of everyday life is to just continue tumbling along unheeding, to actually stop and pause and take stock of your life and decide to not go along with that is considered to be going against the momentum of the culture. So there's a warrior quality to that, very much. I had seen this play out to a certain degree in my own life. I've noticed my lifelong susceptibility to the opinions of others diminishing somewhat. The act of sitting and witnessing the insane torrent of my own mind somehow helps me not take so seriously the clamor of the collective mind. Worrying about what other people think of you, comparing yourself to others, falling prey to the social media-induced FOMO, fear of missing out, these are all painful mental states. It's a relief to have the wherewithal to see them arise and then let them pass without getting overly entranced by them. Jeff often spoke about how meditation led to more spontaneity in himself and in friends and students who practiced. You get less caught up in self-judgments and endless concerns about what other people think. It's very liberating. You feel lighter. To be honest, I do still care what people think. I'm a TV news anchor, after all. On bad days, one mean tweet can preoccupy me for hours. For example, when something like this comes over the transom. You're an idiot. Or this tweet. Why are Paula Faris and Dan Harris so full of themselves? Stop talking over your cohorts. You are neither one that interesting. I maintain that a certain amount of vigilance about the opinions of others can be healthy. Sometimes these mean tweets contain a grain of truth. And if I can get past my instinct to be defensive, I can home in on the constructive part of the criticism and use it to improve. Similarly, when I'm contemplating what my wife or brother or parents might think of a particular action, it can prevent me from doing something dumb. The trick is to separate signal from noise. Meditation has helped me do that, to see whether there is genuine reason for concern or whether I'm stuck in a cul-de-sac of pointless angst. Something else I've observed, even though most of us spend an inordinate amount of time worrying about how we appear to others, the hard truth is that they really don't care that much about you. I remember obsessing over what the public reaction might be to the embarrassing personal revelations in my first book. While there was some blowback, the Daily Mail ran the following headline, "Redemption of a Bald, Miserable Egomaniac," it became clear to me that people were only somewhat interested in my baggage. What they really wanted to know was, what do you have that may be of use to me? An old boss of mine, a man who had been the subject of a few negative headlines himself, used to say that enduring embarrassment is a little bit like being seasick. For you, it feels like the world is ending. For everybody else, it's only mildly amusing. Four cadets who'd been taught meditation joined the conversation, three men and one woman, all seemingly out of central casting. They wore uniforms that had been compulsory at VMI for decades. Crisp black shirts tucked neatly into pressed wool pants with black shoes shined to a mirror finish. Just days earlier, they had been on a 20-mile march in extreme humidity, during which some of them had lost toenails, but no one looked the worse for wear. They exuded an easy, uncontrived confidence in the utility of meditation, public opinion be damned. Elana, a quietly confident cadet, said that the practice had helped her set personal records in her shooting competitions. Jared, a strapping junior, said he had used meditation to calm himself down before baseball games. Quoting Yogi Berra, Baseball is 90% mental, the other half is physical. I was particularly struck by Anthony, an imposing senior who had recently enlisted in the Special Forces and looked like he, too, occasionally enjoyed a lemon for a snack. He said he had learned about meditation from his girlfriend, who, quote, is kind of a wannabe hippie. After she told him how it helped her with stress, he started doing 10 minutes at night in the library. He told us, it definitely changed my evenings and how I felt centered in myself. The voices and the narrative that I was constantly going through in my head just kind of faded away. I was more present in myself. To sit there and listen to this archetypal badass so accurately describe the benefits of meditation made my heart sing. We're taking you on our tour, said Jeff. Finally, there was Al, the quarterback of the football team, who said he had heard about the practice from one of his receivers. Al had decided not to enlist in the armed services after graduation. He was planning to go into ministry. I asked whether he thought meditation might in some way run counter to his Christian faith. Previously, he said, my thoughts on meditation were, it's a kind of Buddhist thing or an Asian Eastern kind of thing. Now I really see it as a practice. I don't see it as a tie to being any kind of faith. I don't think that Jesus looks down upon finding who you are and really just finding your focus and your calmness. I don't think that's anything that conflicts with my beliefs. After our chat, Jeff led a meditation where he discussed the true ninja move of mindfulness, leaning into and learning from whatever storylines and emotions we encounter when meditating rather than playing our usual game of avoidance. Once again, here's Jeff.
Yeah, so as mentioned earlier, there's a classic progression in meditation. First, we work on building up concentration. So focus on the breath, get distracted, come back. Then, once our attention's a little more stable and balanced, we move away from the breath and get curious about the distractions themselves, which are loaded with information about our go-to thought patterns, our preoccupations, our triggers. This stuff is extremely useful to explore. It's like pulling back the curtain on the mind's hidden dramas.
I really like where you're going here, dude, but please resist your temptation to get too weird. Thin ice.
Is nothing I do ever good enough for you, Dad?
I'm Dan.
And I'm a defensive son who apparently still feels the need to prove himself to his 70-something parental units. This rather cliched hangover from my kiddo years continues to live and simmer under the surface. It once caused me to lash out or to lose hours stewing and muttering. I still do this, but thankfully less often and in a less escalating fashion. Meditation has helped me notice this pattern, or more precisely, it's helped me get familiar both with the typical triggers that set me off and with the early warning signs that I'm beginning to get hijacked. So a besieged hunch in my shoulders or a vibratory urgency through my core, a twitchy combativeness in my hands. I'm more likely to notice this stuff now, and once I've noticed it, I'm less likely to go along with the pattern. The whole thing's easier to laugh off.
That's great for you. I assume, however, that you're planning at some point to connect all of this to a human being whose name is not Jeff Warren.
Ha, ha, just laughing off the criticisms. So it turns out being a human being means that our patterns are getting activated all the time, including when we sit with our eyes closed. Fortunately, the more practice we have noticing them, the less likely we are to automatically get sucked in. And that is what this meditation is about. It's pattern noticing school. Once something is seen, it can't really be unseen. It can still be overlooked and ignored and temporarily forgotten. Hell, it can be triggered and re-triggered another 500 times so that we despair of ever actually learning anything in this confounded life. But at least it will never again be totally unknown to us. And if we keep practicing, there's a very good chance it will eventually be so known to us that it will no longer be a problem at all. So for this meditation, we'll begin with a loose focus on the breath. But as soon as we get distracted by something, we'll get curious about the nature of that particular takeover. What hidden drama is happening here? For this, noting is our friend. Using little silent spoken descriptors like spacing out, or stewing, or tension. The idea is to keep the words simple and accurate and to not try to overthink the whole thing.
I want to pick up on the idea of noting. Some people get tripped up on this concept. After all, noting is thinking, right? In fact, it's thinking about thinking, which leads many people I've met to ask, isn't this the opposite of what we're supposed to be doing in meditation?
Noting is the skillful use of thinking in the service of insight. It shows that you're mindful of what's happening. The idea is to just name the distraction with a calm tone and then return to the breath. Doing this can actually be very helpful for overthinkers because it co-opts a bunch of your thinking bandwidth. There's often a bit of a learning curve. Usually after a while, the mind stops playing games and noting just becomes automatic. Until that time, just do the best you can. Or don't note at all. That is always an option. Noting is a useful tool only if it actually helps you stay on track. But give the tool an honest chance before you abandon it. Of course, in keeping with the whole investigatory spirit of this meditation, the ultimate deft move if you find yourself in a thinking storm is to note overthinking. Overthinking is also an extremely useful pattern to notice. Noting it can pop you right out of your downward ruminatory spiral. There are so many potential patterns to discover, it's shocking. For example, you might be with the breath and nothing else seems to be happening, and then you realize you're kind of waiting for something to happen. That's a pattern. Note waiting. Note expecting. The layers are often very subtle, and we never think to notice them because we're inside them. But patience and curiosity are amazingly effective. They can illuminate a pattern like a shot of iridescent dye in a pool of murky water. When we notice and name a thing, we immediately pan back the camera, snap, to a bigger picture. From this place, we can respond more sanely. Sanity, it turns out, is a trainable skill. Investigating patterns, a meditation. 10 to 20 minutes. Get in your meditative position and bring your attention to your breath. Take a few deep breaths and begin to calibrate yourself a bit, relaxing on the exhale, straightening on the inhale, and generally setting the intention to not be uptight about this whole potentially very uptight-making meditation. Your breath is your starting point, your home base, the place to come back to. The idea is to let the sensation of breathing pull you in, but not pull you in so far that you lose any sense of a wider perspective around the breath. As always, noting helps. In, out. If the breath bothers you, note bothered and choose a different anchor. Maybe the feeling of warmth in your hands, a point in your belly, contact with the ground, or even external sounds. Once you've chosen a direction for your attention, lightly commit to it. So here we go, business as usual, noticing the nice cool sensation of breathing in, and then, WTF! Where did I go? Who did that? You look around for someone to blame? Only yourself. Apparently you suck at meditating. Note, judgment. We have a new object of meditation. A grumbly critical inner voice, a sudden uptightness in your posture, the hint of an exasperated scowl, judgment. Call it what you want, but be nice. Friendliness is key. We're not trying to cultivate any weird schizoid inner antagonisms here. Judgment, you say, like judgment is the most charming fellow you've ever met. How excellent to make your acquaintance. Who is this rather dashing, sharp-tongued part of you? Where does it live? What body sensations are associated with it? What storylines? What parental timbres and words and tone? Note any part of it. Judging. Thinking. Tension. Welcome it. Feel it. Explore it. And, when you're ready, return to the breath. Of course, nothing like this may be happening, and that's fine. Just stay with the breath in a relaxed and easygoing manner. But it may happen that, in a very secret way, some pattern rises up below you unannounced, like a large, invisible whale. Gulp. In you go. Swallowed whole. Maybe the whale is resignation. You realize you have already decided that nothing's going to happen. Note, resignation. Or irritation. That idiot teacher has no idea what he's talking about, true in most things. Note, irritation. Or boredom. Really? this is meditation. My life isn't changed yet. I don't see any magic iridescent dyes. I could be watching television. Note, boredom. Back to the breath. You get the idea. It's about staying curious and seeing our distractions and discontents as learning opportunities. It may be that most distractions are simple physical or external ones. Indigestion, itching, pain, sound. That's fine too. Or maybe you brought them with you into the meditation. Sourness, anxiety, speediness. And you could benefit from getting some perspective. The general rule is, if it's strong enough to pull you away from your breath, note it, and then explore it for a while. How do you know you're in a distraction? Where are you experiencing it? In your body? Your mind? What part? How tight is it? Where does it grip? Can you let it go? Follow this strange pattern like a private investigator of consciousness. When you're ready, go back to feeling the breath. But of course, most meditation isn't this cut and dried. It's more like we're half paying attention to the breath and half doing this other thing that we do that we don't really know that we do, right? Can you notice that thing? Can you name it, open to it, gently trace it out? Curiosity is king here. There are no problems in this meditation, only things to exist with and around in a good-natured exploratory way. The ninja move of this practice is to let everything be there, sitting like a champ inside the full sensate surround, from the most delicate and understated sensations to the most coarse and insistent. Work smart. If something gets too intense, you can always return to the breath, to your home base. It's up to you to decide how much you want to go into an uncomfortable pattern, a dynamic we'll explore in more detail in Chapter 6. When you're ready, take a few moments to just relax and drift, and then open your eyes. Cheat sheet. 1. Choose a home base for your attention, somewhere to start and return to. The breath, hands, seat, belly, sound. Do this for a while. 2. If something pulls you away, or if you happen to notice something subtly interfering with your experience, get curious about that something. Note it. Thinking. Anger. Discomfort. And so on. Try to have a welcoming attitude. 3. Make this distraction the new object of meditation for a while. Where is it happening? Is it familiar? What happens when you observe it? Does it get more intense or less? Does it change or stay the same? Explore for a minute or two, and then return to the breath.
When we opened our eyes and started talking about what we had just done, the cadets seemed genuinely enthused. Ilana mentioned that she had leaned into some mild indigestion during the sit, and that doing so had, quote, helped tone it down a lot. Al, the quarterback and aspiring pastor, reported something more psychologically significant. He said, "The thing that I really focused on was people's thoughts about me. That's one thing I've always struggled with. Even my comments earlier about me thinking that Jesus is okay with this and he's not going to look down upon this, I was like, oh gosh, the whole Christian world is going to see that on ABC News and I'm going to get flack about it. Then I was like, no, that's what I believe and I think that's what I have to stay true to." He concluded, "I guess it's just kind of like a revelation." There is a revelation here for all of us. The kind of meditation Jeff just taught is a revolutionary way to approach being alive. As I said to the cadets, most of us live our lives like this. Something comes up that we don't like, we do everything to get rid of it, think about something else, eat something, go shopping, take a drug, whatever. But with meditation, the approach is entirely different. If I'm pissed off about something, or I'm scared about something, or I'm bummed about it, I'm going to be a warrior and I'm going to feel it fully. I'm just going to lean into that thing. And you see in many cases that this isn't going to kill me, or it's not as bad as I thought it was, or actually I can handle it. Jeff added that if you live your life refusing to feel certain things, you're essentially closing a series of doors in your mind. He said, it's like you live in a mansion, but now you're just going to live underneath the stairs. You're not even going into those other rooms because that's where I broke up with my ex. Or that's my feeling of besieged inadequacy around my parents, and man, stay out of there. That's my embarrassingly low self-esteem. This is not easy to do, of course, but Jeff said, if you can just open up each door and face it, you may find there is actually no monster in there. It's manageable. Bit by bit, you start to get more and more free in your life, so you can just live bigger and bigger and more fearlessly and with more and more freedom. This strategy can be applied to all kinds of worries, including worries about people thinking you're weird for meditating. For the record, I am referring here mostly to run-of-the-mill mental churn. We will have a lot more to say about deeper struggles, including trauma, soon. If you are encountering challenges in meditation, know that you're not alone. Difficulties in practice are so common that ancient masters went to great lengths to exhaustively categorize them. They called them the hindrances, or sometimes the defilements, which Jeff thinks sounds like a middle-aged R&B band from Belfast. There are five main hindrances: sloth and torpor, which together constitute one hindrance, desire, aversion, restlessness and worry, and doubt. These categories are broad enough to cover most of the issues that can arise in a practice, so let's walk through them now with Jeff. This is an FAQ we're calling the hindrances. First one, Jeff, help. I'm bored out of my mind while meditating. What do I do?
Boredom is related to sloth, a superb word, as is sleepiness. They're variations of mind-body lethargy, where you have no energy and feel dull and heavy and uninterested in stuff. Or we can be totally spaced out and numb. One way to combat this is to get energized, to first notice what's happening, and then to try to summon up some curiosity about it. So curiosity is energizing. The opinionated side of boredom, the judgment that something's boring, can be looked at like anything else. Where is boring in this sound, this sensation, this situation? You bring it with you. So get curious and see if you can find where this feeling lives. The curiosity itself can dispel the boredom, and it's very liberating to no longer be yanked around by what for many of us can be a chronic sense of dissatisfaction. We'll get more into this in a minute. Of course, if you're really bored, you can also just stop meditating and go for a fast walk or jump up and down or dunk your head in a sink full of ice cubes.
Yeah, I always keep a sink full of ice cubes handy. Those tactics would probably also help with another very, very common problem, which is sleepiness.
For sure. Here are a few other things you can try when you feel sleepy. One, meditate when you're most alert. For example, first thing when you get up, or after your morning workout or coffee. The timing will be a little bit different for everyone. That said, it's probably not a good idea to meditate after a meal. The digestive process can make you feel a bit dozy. Two, a few big inhales can help oxygenate the body, as can deliberately stretching up your spine. Three, meditate with your eyes open. Four, you can note out loud either sleepiness and or the breath, in, out. So noting helps. Five, probably the most effective intervention, so listen up. You can meditate standing. Or six, you can do a quick walking meditation, as per above, to get the blood moving. If you're persistently sleepy, it's also quite possible that what you really need right now isn't meditation, but a nap.
Okay, so let's move on to another hindrance. What about desire? Not infrequently in my meditation, I will find myself wanting to check my phone or yearning for ice cream or planning my next TV binge. What do you do about that?
I know it well. During many meditations, I've been lost in lustful fantasies or visualizing a cheeseburger or, and for this I repent, both simultaneously. Often we don't even know what we desire. It's just all-purpose wanting, like the feeling of walking down the street and wanting to buy something, or that pervasive teenager sense of wanting something, anything, to happen, even if you have no idea what. Using noting can really help. Wanting. 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 If you can stay with this feeling, a very liberating and powerful moment can sometimes happen. The wanting itself passes, and you realize you're actually fine. More than fine. Happy. Content with how things are. And you realize how many hundreds of hours you have been and will be again lost in this pattern, robotically indulging your novelty seeking, when, had you just thought to look, the urge would eventually pop like an empty soap bubble, and you could finally relax. This, by the way, is called an insight in Buddhism, an experience of truth. Insights make an aha noise as they pass through your heart, and then they land in your belly with a thunk. In this case, you realize, one, wow, this pattern has influenced a lot of my life. And then two, but much of the time there hasn't really been anything wrong. So you sit with that for a while, digesting. And then you get up, and 20 minutes later, you're hopelessly fixated on your Facebook feed. Meditation works, but it can take time for the bigger insights to sink in.
Absolutely true in my experience. So let's talk about desire's Janus-faced opposite, aversion.
Variations of pushing away, from fear and subtle dislike all the way to hate, repugnance, and anger. All of these are aversion. And you can work with them the same way. Note fear. Note dislike. Note anger. They're all part of our natural fight-or-flight response. I've definitely struggled with anger in my life and in my practice, and I can say that I've been consistently amazed at the number of things a human being can find to get angry about in a silent sit. Anger at discomfort. Anger at the teacher for clearly being a fool. Anger at yourself for being a bad meditator. And even irrational Homer Simpson-style anger at the object of your focus. Stupid breath, so that you convince yourself there's something much better to be meditating on. It turns out that we can get into furious fight-or-flight spirals with ourselves. It's like evolution imploded backwards into our brains.
So is there an antidote to anger?
The classic one is loving-kindness meditation. Basically, when you notice you're mad, you try to do a meditation that's all about deliberately evoking feelings of care and friendliness for yourself, your pals, strangers, the whole creaturely shebang. Dan loves these practices. Sometimes he floats down the street and imagines throwing his golden lasso of love around everyone he sees. We'll explore a few variations of these meditations later in the book.
It's almost like you know me.
Dan, unlike your very well-known aversion to loving-kindness, many of our aversions are unconscious. And when we look closely, we can sometimes detect a faint layer of friction or tugging around what we're thinking and feeling and hearing and seeing. I like it. I don't like it. I like it. I don't like it. Push, pull, push, pull. Want, don't want, want, don't want. All of this struggle, this lack of equanimity. It's there in a conspicuous macro way, in terms of our opinions and judgments and likes and don't likes, but it's also there in an understated micro way, in terms of our tiny winces and bracings and averted gazes, as well as our little pulses of zeal, of grabbiness, of indulgence. You start to see how desire and aversion are like two paddles in a giant pinball machine, launching and relaunching our spinning little heads around the game board of life.
Anyway, this seems like a very good place to say more about how to work with physical pain, where aversion is the natural response.
Physical pain from sitting, in the knees, the legs, the hips, the back, is one of the classic meditative training grounds for how to develop equanimity or lack of resistance. Obviously, if you're in pain, it's fine to move. But if you're feeling ambitious, you can also learn a lot about how aversion works. You can learn to observe and open to your pain in a way that actually makes the pain less of a problem. I have to give a shout out here to my teacher, Shinzen Young, who wrote an excellent book about how meditation can help with chronic pain. His formula is one every human being should memorize. Suffering equals pain times resistance. Pain is an inevitable part of life. Suffering, in his definition, is not. It comes from fighting or resisting some uncomfortable sensation or emotion or whatever. When we do this, there's a snowball effect. Tension spreads, and the original insult starts to reverberate through the whole mind-body tract, leading to even more discomfort, stress, and reactivity. The suffering amplifies. You can literally watch this dynamic play out when your knee starts to hurt when you meditate. So there's the pain of it, but then there's also your panicked judgments about the pain. Oh man, this is only going to get worse. There's a bracing in the body and the face. There might be a slight holding of the breath, and there's almost always that subtle aversion layer being activated. So one meditative solution is to, rather counterintuitively, focus on the center of the sensation of pain itself, relaxing and breathing into it, trying to let go of your aversion and develop a kind of field naturalist curiosity and acceptance instead. You watch your pain like it's an intriguing little animal. When we do this, the pain itself can diminish dramatically, and sometimes it even disappears.
I've had that experience. So let's move to the next hindrance now, restlessness, worry, and anxiety. How do you deal with these?
I am happy to be the poster boy for this particular defilement. This is partly an energy issue. Too much juice, too much excitability, full of beans, as my grandpappy used to say. In the body, this manifests as fidgetiness, agitation, and sometimes the desire to bolt, or, I've actually had this, punch yourself in the face. In the mind, it comes up as scattered or persistent thinking, being distracted by everything, landing nowhere, always worrying and making plans. Plans! I love plans! Plans about how to get away from here, so I can immediately make a new plan about how to get away from there. These and other derangements of the monkey mind have sadly occupied a large portion of my adult life. So, what do we do? Well, first of all, give yourself a break. You've got beans. It's a good thing. Those beans just need to be channeled or discharged, and there are many ways to do them. Let me list them. Number one, if you have crazy energy during a particular meditation, then for God's sake, stop. You need physical activity, like martial arts or pole vaulting or trench digging. Get outside and get into the dirt and let Mama Earth ground your zing. You can go back to sitting when you're feeling more settled. Number two, long exhales. Your breath is your best friend in life and in meditation. Breathing in and up can raise your energy when you're low. Breathing out and down can lower your energy when you're high. So if you're really agitated, try taking some deliberate, long, slow exhales. And as you do, you can imagine your energy settling and draining into the ground. Number three, be a ninja of equanimity. Notice agitation or excitement or anxiety in your body. But as you do, imagine yourself as a wide open container. So be distantly curious about how the vibrations play themselves out. So the big trick here is not to feed the energy, not to get too curious and thus accidentally entangled. I tell my students, do not feed the beast. So much of my own practice has been about learning to breathe out, back off, and return to a grounding sensation. We'll come back to this theme in a big way in chapters 6 and 7. Finally, number 4, find stillness. Stillness is very healing. The good news is we don't always have to wait until we're relaxed to find it. Often a subtle quality of stillness or silence or steadiness already exists in some part of our experience. So it might be under the softest part of the breath or in the pause between breaths. Or at a point in the belly, or maybe as a noticeable quiet around us or even inside us. So if you have strong energy or agitation going on, is there something unchanging somewhere in your mind and body? Some quality or sensation you can deliberately focus on? Even if it's just a hint, hold yourself very still and try to delicately make contact, not in any rush. Breathing calmly, soothing yourself. This kind of exploration can be a real game changer. It is the path of self-regulation.
All right, last hindrance, doubt. I have this one in spades.
Am I doing this right? Am I wasting my time? Am I forever unfit for meditation? Note doubt. Note doubt. There's nothing wrong with healthy questioning. This hindrance refers more to a chronic inability to commit, which can actively prevent the full experience from unfolding. It's not unlike romantic relationships. If you're always on the fence, you'll never know the depths of connection that total acceptance and commitment bring. Clear instruction helps, as does a teacher you feel confident in, and an understanding of both the dynamics involved and your personal reason for practicing. so can having a mature patience with the whole process, which inevitably includes periods when you're going to be confused and unsure and thick-headed. That's okay. That's life. Everyone who's ever meditated has gone through periods of being terrible at meditation and doubting themselves. That's why they named a hindrance after it. So be like Kurt Vonnegut. So it goes. One final thing to say. Hindrances don't just happen in meditation. They happen in life. And it's useful to at least try to notice them. We start to see how incredibly pervasive they are and how they can distort our view of things and actually prevent us from being present and available to the people around us. And sometimes a hindrance can mask a deeper issue. So desire can mask loneliness, or agitation can cover fear, or sleepiness can be a form of avoidance. Lots of possible permutations. A meditation teacher I like named Gil Fronsdale calls these strategies of resistance, patterns of reactivity that our unconscious uses to dodge uncomfortable feelings and situations. The Buddhists are masters of noticing this stuff. They have an awesome phrase, guarding the sense doors. It means being good-naturedly vigilant about what we spend time doing and thinking about, because those things have a pervasive effect on our moods and our dispositions. In the words of another teacher, Steve Armstrong, the hindrances can become our personality. But not all of it, and hopefully not for long, as we become more skilled at the practice.
On the bus that night, as we headed to the next stop on our tour, I decided to check in with Jeff about something that was worrying me. Have you felt criticized at all when we pick on you for getting all mystical schmistical? I asked. Ben and I had been teasing him for dropping phrases such as enjoying your beingness while we were trying to appeal to skeptics. He said, sometimes it feels lonely to be hanging out with a bunch of secular folks when you know the most important fucking thing in the world is to understand the sacred fact that you're alive. His face was radiating geniality, notwithstanding the F-bomb. He continued, sometimes I get reactive around that. There's a defensive quality that can come up, which doesn't do me any good. It doesn't help the cause. On the other hand, I'm pretty easygoing. My relationship with my friends has always been a teasing one. We bust each other's balls. I kind of enjoy it. Apparently, even meditation MacGyvers care what other people think of them. In fact, while I was spending this concentrated time in close quarters with Jeff, the complexity of his personality was coming into focus for me. I was starting to realize that many of his core personality traits, including a sensitivity to criticism that was seemingly at odds with his external insouciance, could be traced back to the ADD. When he was a boy, the condition had contributed to him being hyperactive, impetuous, and basically a pain in the neck for his exhausted parents. Jeff often felt criticized, a dynamic that had residual impacts even now. It also led to what I consider to be a strange resistance to raising his public profile. During our wandering retreat several months before, I had encouraged Jeff to be more ambitious. I couldn't understand why a teacher as brilliant as him wasn't better known. At first, he pushed back by insisting he liked to keep things simple. But then he admitted that part of his reluctance was connected to his ADD. He had a habit of popping off and saying things he later regretted, and a propensity for taking on too many responsibilities and then getting overwhelmed. Both of these behaviors undermined his confidence. He didn't know how to ask for help and felt embarrassed for even having these problems as a meditation teacher, i.e., in his words, someone who's supposed to have his shit together on every level. All of which goes to show that just because you start meditating does not mean that every one of your deep patterns and mental habits will evaporate. Even people who teach meditation for a living suffer. But the great ones, like Jeff, harness their neuroses in ways that allow them to better connect with the people they're trying to help. For my part, even after years of meditation, I still notice plenty of anger, impatience, and other distractions in my own mind. For instance, while meditating with the cadets earlier in the day, I was besieged by all sorts of random thoughts. What's the funniest name for a historical military encounter? That's easy. Battle of Salamis. Really happened. Big fight between the Greeks and Persians in 480 BC. Would have been awesome if it was followed by the War of Pastrami's, the Siege of Mortadella, and Last Stand at Pimento Loaf. When I find myself thinking about nonsense or getting angry for no readily apparent reason, I often add an extra layer of suffering by telling myself, you're a meditation advocate now. You have no business feeling this way. This is a complete waste of energy. You can't control what arises in your own mind. It comes out of a mysterious void. You can only control how you respond. The move isn't to artificially squash your emotions. They will only reemerge elsewhere. No, the move is to use the tools that Jeff just taught us. Lean into whatever is coming up and try to see it without judgment so that you can respond wisely. Do this enough, and over time, you may even starve your unwholesome patterns of oxygen by not feeding them with compulsive thinking. As our orange bus headed south through the inky Virginia night, Jeff expounded on an extra ingredient that speeds up this process of handling your emotions. The true warrior move is not just to see your hindrances clearly, but also to send them a little friendliness. By way of example, he revealed one of his own neurotic patterns. As a result of feeling chastened as a kid, he said, I internalized this voice that I now call El Grandioso. The voice would compensate for perceived criticism by telling Jeff how well he was doing. He said, it was kind of pathetic, but it would be like my own personal cheerleader in my corner. El Grandioso would exaggerate and distort what was really going on around him, goading him into riskier and even more ridiculous behaviors. This contributed to Jeff's various excesses, lots of partying, and injuries, broken neck, climbing and biking accidents, through his teens and 20s, to say nothing of how it prevented honest and direct connection with other members of Homo sapiens. But through meditation, he said, he had developed the ability, most of the time at least, to notice this voice before it overtook him. Now when El Grandioso pops up, Jeff deliberately sends the voice a wave of friendliness. As he told us on the bus, I'm like, oh, there you are. Haven't heard from you in a while, buddy. How you doing? Jeff turned and studied me carefully across the bus's small dining table. I've noticed something about you, Dan, he said. You still have an asshole in your head. We were back now to talking about the joyless, airless, eat-your-vegetables nature of my practice. Jeff suggested that I try to see my inner crank as lovable. He said, the asshole is basically a protective program. You internalized an asshole at some point in your life. It was trying to help you. It was trying to make Dan have the best life Dan could have. So it was working for a while. Then it outlived its use. Now it's an anachronism. He said I should give the pattern a name, he recommended Robert Johnson, and send him a little love. Whenever Robert Johnson's coming up, be like, hey, Robert, what do you have to say now, buddy? When you remove the reactivity, he said, it, quote, just defangs Robert. I was intrigued by this, but it also seemed a little corny. I was fine identifying the fact that the ghost of Robert Johnson would continue to show up in my interior life, but I wasn't so sure I was game for naming a bunch of my inner characters and systematically sending them good vibes. I told him I'd take it under consideration. I was actually a bit distracted during this conversation. As Jeff and I were discussing our alter egos in the bus's dining area, the camera crew was on the bench opposite recording the exchange. My eye was repeatedly drawn to Eddie, our director, who seemed distracted, staring unhappily at his phone. Why wasn't Eddie having fun? I knew he was a little tired, but this is the meditating since he was 8 surfer dude. Plus, this whole road trip was his idea, after all. I was worried about Eddie, but there was also, to be frank, a touch of Robert Johnson lurking. How dare someone not fully enjoy my road trip? I didn't realize it at the time, but we had all been ignoring one of our core principles, and it would soon come to a head. Chapter 5. Meditation is Self-Indulgent. On the morning of day 7 of our cross-country meditation peregrinations, I was standing in the lobby of a hotel in Nashville contemplating the fact that Continental Breakfast is a misleadingly grand name for a basket filled with half-stale bagels when I ran into Eddie. He was lugging the gear he would need for our first shoot of the day. Again, he was looking harried and exhausted. By contrast, I was feeling peppy since I'd had a full night's sleep and had managed to get up early and sneak in a workout. As we waited for the rest of the team to join us, I inquired gingerly about his mood. He sighed deeply and said, "I'm just not getting much sleep." As we talked, I quickly began to realize that he had every reason to feel run down. Eddie was genuinely being put through the ringer. Each day when the rest of us headed to bed, he would stay up for several hours more, recharging the gear and loading all the video we had shot onto a hard drive. He and the crew would also have to rise earlier than the rest of us to get their equipment ready. Then they had to run around all day with heavy cameras or audio kit. Both Eddie and our director of photography, Nick Lopez, were shooting during this trip. We also had a sound man, Dennis Haggerty. And it didn't end there for Eddie. As the creative director of this project, he was also in charge of the look of each of the many shoots we would do, often on the fly. It wasn't that Eddie disliked any of his responsibilities per se. The opposite was true. He approached his work with an earnest and seemingly effortless zeal. The real issue was that our movable meditation feast had become a rather shambolic affair. The trip had been planned carefully in advance, but now that we were actually on the road, some sizable logistical issues had emerged. Turns out crossing the country in 11 days requires covering a lot of ground every day, and since we had resolved after the first night never again to sleep on the bus, we didn't have much time to get the day's shooting done. In order to make the schedule work, we needed military efficiency, which we manifestly did not have. Part of this was due to a communications mix-up. Eddie thought Ben, the 10% happier CEO, would be playing the role of Julie the cruise director, making sure everything ran on time. Ben did not share that impression. The leadership vacuum created disorganization, which left us constantly running late. This meant the crew would often get screwed on sleep, and that is what was really frustrating Eddie. Though he was sleep-deprived himself, he was more concerned about the welfare of his team. In fact, on this morning, Eddie was shooting solo so his crew could sleep in. So Eddie was tired. And if Eddie was tired, it was a real problem. This guy is no malingerer. Having spent much of my career out in the field shooting stories, I knew firsthand how morale problems can metastasize and poison the atmosphere. However, when I tried to get under this particular hood, Eddie, in his low-key manner, basically shut me down. He assured me that everything would be fine, that he was a team player, etc. Before I could query him any further, the rest of the gang showed up and we were off on our tight schedule for the day. As we headed out to meet our next set of interviewees, I was struck by the irony of the situation. Here we were, tromping across the country, trying to convince people to conduct regular mental maintenance, and all the while we were inadvertently putting Eddie and his team in a position where they couldn't take care of themselves. The unfortunate situation in which we had placed Eddie and the crew brought into stark relief an issue we had been encountering throughout the trip. People are burned out from their jobs, from their family responsibilities, and from all the pressures of 21st century living. Either they are unable to take sufficient care of themselves, as in Eddie's case, or they actively resist doing so. The latter was our next big obstacle, the belief among so many that self-care is self-indulgent. And, of course, the most self-indulgent flavor of self-care imaginable is sitting with your eyes closed doing nothing. This psychology was articulated by a speech-language pathologist we met on our trip named Leslie Wandenberg. She told us she felt awful every time she took 5 minutes to meditate because she would immediately start contemplating all the other ways she might have used that time. She said, "I could have been maybe coming up with more things to do with my baby. I could have given my husband 5 minutes of, 'How was your day? Let's talk about your things.' So guilt has been my biggest barrier. As soon as I start to relax, I think, 'Oh my goodness, I shouldn't be relaxing. This is so bad. Why am I so selfish?'" Let's not sugarcoat it. Meditation can be self-indulgent. Like anything else, it is certainly possible to use this form of self-care to the detriment of other important things in your life. However, it is also true that if you want to take care of other people, You simply cannot do so effectively if you are not taking adequate care of yourself. It's the old cliche from the airline safety instructions: put your own mask on before assisting others. In fact,